We'll hear arguments next in 76446, Pecunier against Navarette. Proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, may I at the outset reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. The question presented by this case is whether a complaint alleging that state prison officials negligently lost 13 items of a prisoner's outgoing mail in 1971 and 1972 states a cause of action under 42 United States Code, Section 1983. The Civil Rights Act. This question reached this court in the following way. On January 4, 1974, Respondent Navarette, with his present counsel, filed a second amended complaint in the United States District Court for the Northern District of California, solely for damages. He alleged that while he was a California prisoner in 1971 and 1972 at Soledad Prison, 13 items of his outgoing mail were not received by his addressees. In his first and second causes of action, he alleged that the defendants deliberately refused to send these letters, either one, in knowing disregard, or two, in bad faith disregard of the prisoner's First Amendment right of free expression. These causes of action are not before the court. In his third cause of action, it is alleged that the letters were not received because the defendants negligently and inadvertently mishandled the mail. It is this cause of action, and only this cause of action, which is before this court. Now, there is one matter, Your Honor, I would like to set to one side at this time. There is a suggestion in respondent's brief in this court that the claim of mail loss involved or resulted in a denial of access to the courts as well as the denial of free expression. That is not the case. I must point out that in the lower courts, respondent expressly stated the following, and I quote, "The claim against mail interference does not purport to allege denial of access to the courts," unquote. And we take counsel and respondent at his word. He told.
Where do we find that in the appendix?
You find that in the record at page 17. It is not in the appendix. It was not printed for the appendix, but it is in the record that was sent from the Ninth Circuit to this court. It also appears in the reply brief in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals at page 7 and page 9. Now,
may I ask a question about that particular point?
Yes.
Does it really matter? As I understand your general submission, it is that an allegation of negligence is insufficient under 1983. Are you suggesting there are different standards depending on what the constitutional violation is? In other words, if it were a denial of access to the courts, perhaps negligence would be enough?
Justice Stevens, I'm not suggesting that at all. I'm just trying to clear up a matter that seems to have reappeared in the briefs in this court that I thought had been cleared up earlier and was not before this court. And I want to make that clear, that the denial of access is not in question here.
But your basic position is that even if it were before us, your argument would be precisely the same.
That's correct.
Well, counsel, are we focusing here on some sort of a gloss that is added to the burden of proof of a plaintiff because the action is brought under 1983, or should we focus on the definition of the constitutional right itself? Supposing this case had been brought in the Superior Court of California, where you don't have to rely on 1983, a court of general jurisdiction, would your arguments be the same?
No. California has a procedure for suing public officials who act negligently. And so in tort law, and it would not be a constitutional cause of action at all.
Well, but couldn't you assert a 14th Amendment claim in the Superior Court of whatever county Soledad is located?
As a matter of fact, Your Honor, the California Supreme Court has held in the last 2 years that they have concurrent jurisdiction under Section 1983 and would entertain, and the state courts may entertain 1983 causes of action in the state courts.
But does it take 1983 to enable a superior court to entertain a constitutional cause of action?
Probably not. I think that there would be independent state causes of action available.
What do you conceive to be the constitutional right that the respondents assert here?
The respondents assert an inmate's right of free expression in the mail. I have to remind the court again and again that it's the inmate who's bringing this suit. It's not the addressees. And that kind of gets me to the second part of my argument now, but the point we make in the second part of our argument in our briefs is that in Procunier versus Martinez in 1974, this court did not find a right of free expression in the inmate. It found a right of free expression in the free person correspondent. Now, if the free person correspondents were bringing this lawsuit, perhaps we'd have a different case insofar as what the constitutional right was involved. We may not have a different case insofar as whether negligence or intent is before us.
What if we were to decide in this case that the point reserved in Justice Powell's opinion in Procuni against Martinez should be resolved in favor of the respondent, that is, that there is a right of inmates to communicate by letter? Do you think that constitutional right would be violated if a prison truck carrying mail down to the local post office negligently went off the road?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
And yet that doesn't turn on anything to do with 1983. That turns on a definition of the constitutional right, doesn't it?
Well, my understanding of 1983 is that you don't state a cause of action under 1983 unless you can first find a constitutional deprivation.
What happened if the truck went off the road every day?
Your Honor?
Accidentally.
I think that if the truck went off the road every day.
Accidentally.
That a cause of action could be stated under your Honor's formulation in Estelle versus Gamble, that might constitute sufficient evidence to support a claim of deliberate indifference. And respondents here has two claims of intentional tort, of deliberate refusal, of deliberate indifference, under which he may attempt to assert that what happened to him constituted.
How many times is mail negligently not delivered?
The allegation in this complaint is that 13 items of mail over a period of 1.5 years were not delivered. I should point out, Your Honor, that the record in this case shows that over 150 pieces of special purpose mail, that is mail to attorneys, reporters, courts, public officials, were mailed on behalf of the respondent. And this is in addition to routine correspondence to family and friends of which no record is kept in the California prison system. So what we're looking at is 13 pieces of mail out of at least more than 150 that records are kept of. We don't know how many more of which no records are kept. Your Honor, in a case I tried in the U.S. District Court 2 years ago concerning San Quentin Prison, a prison comparable in size to Soledad, the record was undisputed that over 3,000 to 4,000 pieces of mail were handled per day. If you translate that into a year and a half, you're talking in excess of 1.5 million pieces of mail. And all we have a complaint in this case is that 13 pieces were lost in that period. 13 out of 1.5 million is a very small fraction. We have no other allegation in this complaint that any other prisoners are subjected to.
For the purpose of this case, it's admitted.
That 13 pieces were lost. Negligently. Yes. Well, let me get back to my discourse.
Before you get back, you say we approached this case on the assumption that 13 pieces were lost negligently.
That's the allegation in the complaint.
And, do you say it was just through negligent conduct in the sense that, such as Mr. Justice Rehnquist was suggesting, they just negligently lost them in a truck somewhere or in a fire, or is that what you're?
Well, let me
we approach it that way.
Let me quote from respondent's brief. In
or
this
that
court.
he thought he was following a regulation and just misread it.
Well, in this court, respondent states the following: that the mail was, quote, unaccountably lost or mislaid due to inadvertent mishandling, unquote.
So it's sort of a, it would just be an unconscious act, just a negligent act.
There was one piece of mail in which he makes a specific allegation that it was refused mailing, and that then the reason was given for the refusal. But I find that not to bear on this negligence claim, because there was a deliberate refusal and a reason was given. That does not fall within our negligence cause of action.
Well, but if you read
within the deliberate,
but if you read page 12 of the appendix, at paragraph 2 of the third cause of action, it says defendants negligently and inadvertently misapplied the prisoner mail regulation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It seems to me you could, under the rules of pleading, show that they refused to mail that because they didn't properly understand the regulation, rather than the idea that just got left in a drawer when everybody else's mail went ahead.
Well, Justice Rehnquist, that might be true in the ordinary case where only one cause of action was alleged. But the fact is, in this case, three causes of action are alleged with respect to the mail. And in the first two, the allegations are that there was a deliberate refusal to send the mail. Deliberate refusal. Now, in the third cause of action, the allegation is a negligent and inadvertent mishandling. I take it and misapplication of the regulations. But I take that to mean pure carelessness, not that they misunderstood the rules. I took that to be what was happening with respect to the deliberate refusal.
But Mr. Attorney General, you're reading the brief rather than the pleading, as Justice Rehnquist points out. The language is proximate result of interference with or confiscation of such correspondence by reason of negligent understanding of the rules and so on. The word confiscation and interference certainly is not just ordinary mishandling, is it? That isn't a truck going off the bank of the river or whatever it was.
Well, Your Honor, as I understand these three causes of action, as they have been pleaded through four complaints in the lower courts, they were dealt with below as two causes of action for deliberate refusal, the third cause of action for negligent loss of the mail. That's the way they've been dealt with below. This is not a Haynes versus Kerner situation where respondent does not have counsel. He has counsel. Counsel was the same counsel throughout from the Second Amendment complaint on. And I have to take counsel at his word that what he means by his complaint is that the mail was unaccountably lost or mislaid due to inadvertent mishandling.
Do you think we should look at the brief rather than the pleading itself? Isn't the test still the test under any conceivable facts can be shown under the pleading that will entitle them to relief, and so forth and so on?
If under any conceivable facts, if the allegation is confiscation, it seems to me that confiscation can be dealt with at trial under the twin allegations that are not before this court, namely deliberate indifference.
Well, but it's negligence in the sense that he didn't study the regulations and realize that this was not the kind of mail he was supposed to refuse to deliver. The particular act was intentional, but the negligence was in failing to study the regulation. And then there's a second allegation about negligence in the supervisors not training their people on how to handle the mail. That's not the kind of negligence that you're talking about with a truck going off the road, is it?
Well, that's the kind of negligence which the Court of Appeals held stated a cause of action. And that's the kind of negligence we took in our petition to certiorari to this court to ask this court to say does not state a cause of action.
Well, Mr. Speckle, let me interrupt you once more, and then I will try to keep my mouth shut because I've taken more of your time than I should. Isn't it possible that the Court of Appeals could be wrong and yet this part of the complaint state a claim for relief?
Only if it was construed to state a claim for relief for deliberate indifference, in that the confiscation was so repeated as to constitute a deliberate indifference to the right of free expression. But to say that an act of inadvertence and mistake constitutes a constitutional deprivation as opposed to a tort, I have difficulty with construing as a constitutional deprivation. My point is that if it happens often enough as alleged, the answer is the causes of action and deliberate indifference recognized by this court. It's not in a windfall cause of action in negligence. In other words, negligence is traditionally dealt with in tort law. Let's put ourselves in the area of injunctive relief. I suppose that if respondent was seeking an injunction, he could, by requesting a simple order, do away with an entire body of tort law. All public officials will be told, thou shalt not be negligent. And I'm sure a district court could enter such an order. But whether such an order would be efficacious is doubtful. And the point I'm making is that it seems to me that 1983 is a deterrent statute and not a compensation statute. And the deterrence that it seeks, that is aimed at, is the deterrence of deprivations of constitutional rights.
That you should not destroy this man's mail, negligently or non-negligently. What's wrong with that? And I use the word negligently as you use it, which is not the way I use it.
Your Honor?
Well, tell me, what do you mean by, in this case, what was the negligence?
The negligence, as I understand it, is the unintended conduct which resulted in a loss to the plaintiff. Unintended.
Well, what about those words? There's nothing unintended in those words where you deliberately. Isn't that what they add up to?
The allegation in causes of action 1 and 2 is deliberate. The allegation in clause number 3 has not been construed to be an allegation of deliberate refusal. It's been construed to be an allegation of negligence.
Negligence in understanding the statute, understanding the rules, or negligently going to sleep, or negligently driving off the road.
The complaint alleges negligent and inadvertent misapplication of the rules.
Do you put inadvertence in the same place as negligence?
I put it in the same place because that's the allegation in the complaint. The complaint says defendants negligently and inadvertently misapplied the prisoner mail regulations. And as I understand,
negligently, look, well, let me understand this. The man says here's a letter written to his lawyer, and the man, quote, negligently misunderstands the rules and burns that letter up. Is that negligence?
He burns it up?
Yes. Is that negligence?
No, that's not negligence.
Was that possibly what they're talking about here?
I don't think that's what they're talking about at all.
They could be, though, couldn't they?
I have to take counsel at his word when he says...
What he said...
It was unaccountably lost or mislaid due to inadvertent mishandling. He's not talking about burning it up.
He said negligently on the rules. What did he say about
the rules? He said negligently and inadvertently misapplied the rules.
That's not negligence as I understand it.
Well, Your Honor... That may well be true, but the point is, that is the understanding.
He did violate, do you understand what I mean? He violated the rules? Inadvertently?
And unintentionally, yes.
But he did violate the rules.
That appears to be the case, or at least he misapplied them. Whether violate and misapplied are the same thing, I don't know. He may have applied a different rule, to the wrong type of mail. That's one way of construing it.
In a trial, we'd have found all that up.
At a trial, we will still find it out because there can be a trial under the first and second causes of action, Your Honor.
Does the single question on which we granted certiorari, there was a limited grant, wasn't there?
There was a limited grant.
Does that include the question of whether there indeed is a constitutional right that, with respect to the mail?
The
ambiguous.
Adjudicate this case on the assumption that there was a constitutional right which the prison guard should have known?
Well, the certified question reads as follows, Justice White. Whether negligent failure to mail certain of a prisoner's outgoing letter states a cause of action under Section 1983.
Mm-hmm.
This was addressed to the determination of the Ninth
Circuit. So you think, arguably anyway, the case involves the question of... Even if there was a deliberate loss here, a deliberate refusal to mail,
right.
whether or not the state is liable because no adjudicated right in the mail would have been known by the.
Oh yes, that is our position. That's correct.
Is that issue here? You think
that issue is here insofar as the negligence. Yeah. Claim is concerned, because even as to the negligence claim, there must be an underlying constitutional deprivation. And Regrettably, Your Honors did not certify the first two questions, because we would have welcomed, we'd be happy to be here arguing that there was no First Amendment deprivation in 1971 and 72, even if there was deliberate refusal to
send
the mail.
Well, you do argue that in your brief.
Well, we argue it, but we do argue it as a backstop to the negligence
that's
point.
That's subsumed in the question, isn't it?
That's subsumed in the question certified.
If a deliberate interference with the mail would not constitute a constitutional violation, then a fortiori a negligent one does not.
That's absolutely
that's your point,
correct.
Isn't it?
And even if loss of the mail would be a violation of a constitutional right, it may be the state might not be liable because the right hadn't been sufficiently adjudicated.
That's absolutely correct, and that's what Your Honor said in Pecuniae versus Martinez, that prior to that case, the state of the law as to prisoner mail was totally uncertain, that prison officials had no basis for knowing what to do with it. And it seems to me that Pecuniae versus Martinez applies precisely to our defendants. How are they expected to anticipate this court's decision in 1974?
So if we agreed with you on that particular point, we wouldn't need to get any farther with how much 1983 deals with just mishandling, negligent mishandling.
That's correct.
And we wouldn't get to the point of the question of whether there is, in fact, the underlying substantive constitutional right. Because at least it hadn't been enunciated prior
that's
to this
right.
decision.
That's right. You could resolve the case that way. We had hoped that this case would be decided on the lead point, whether under any circumstances negligent action could invade a constitutional right. And our position on that, as stated in our briefs, is it cannot, should not.
Of course, another way of putting that might be that some constitutional rights are rights against deliberate action, that the right itself is against deliberate action, not against negligent action.
Well, you know, Your Honors have decided a number of cases on about a number of constitutional rights, and I can think of no case yet decided by this court where you didn't require some sort of intent. And I'm thinking of Washington versus Davis, where you say there has to be a purposeful denial of equal protection. I'm thinking of Estelle versus Gamble. There has to be a deliberate indifference before you can have cruel and unusual punishment. I'm thinking of the whole body of Fourth Amendment law. All illegal arrests and illegal searches and seizures are deliberate acts. In Bishop versus Wood, Your Honor, in the due process case involving the employer and their employee that Justice Stevens wrote, my recollection of your language is that the due process clause was not to be used as a means for federal courts to resolve all mistakes by public officials, that there has to be some sort of motive to deprive of a right.
I suppose if a mail truck negligently hit somebody on his way to church, he would hardly have a claim that the government had interfered with his free exercise of religion.
Well, that reminds me some hypotheticals in Amicus's brief. The first hypothetical was that if a prisoner was walking across the exercise yard and negligently run down by a truck driver, that he would concede didn't state a cause of action. But somehow, if the prisoner was walking across the yard and was on his way to church, that would invade his First Amendment right to worship. And I simply cannot see that unless the truck driver knew that the fellow was going to church and ran him down, at how the First Amendment right could be implicated.
Ran him down deliberately.
Right, ran him down deliberately.
Not negligently.
Not negligent. He couldn't. If he knew of the right and he ran him down, I think an inference would be drawn.
Well, if he did it deliberately, you don't need to call on the First Amendment, do you?
We could try him in state court for murder.
What if he just didn't like the guy? He wasn't trying to prevent him from going to church. He just wanted to kill him.
We try him in state court for murder.
Would there be a 1983 cause of action for violation of his religious freedom?
As I understand this court's decisions, there has to be a combination of an intent to do the act and a consciousness that in some fashion that a constitutional right would be implicated.
Well, what about taking somebody's life?
Well,
in the course of your official duties,
well,
on purpose.
You know, the debates on this act considered that when in connection with Section 2 of the Ku Klux Act. If you recall, the original version of that act listed a certain number of crimes, murder, mayhem, assault, with respect to the Ku Klux Klan. And the opponents pointed out that the Due Process Clause has never been thought to protect life, liberty, or property. Those kinds of actions were...
You say a prison guard who beats up a prisoner isn't violating 1983?
Intentional deprivation. Cruel and unusual punishment is implicated.
Now, the Screws case said the only way it could apply is for the guard to say as he was shooting him that I'm shooting you to deny you your constitutional rights. That's what this court said in the Screws case. Am I right?
It said that the word willfully in section 242 of 18 U.S. Code required proof either by direct or circumstantial evidence that the defendant intended to deprive the victim of a constitutional right.
Which means he had to say, as we're shooting him, I am shooting you for the purpose of denying you your right.
He has to either say that or have told someone that on his way to the shooting.
Well, let's say it's perfectly clear the deliberately state officer deliberately murders some person he's just arrested. He just doesn't like him. Is that a deprivation of life without due process?
No, I don't think so. I don't think this court has ever held that, and I don't think that the debates about the surrounding.
But if he deliberately took his life to keep him from going to church, that would be a 1983 action.
In addition to the murder cause of action in state court.
I know. I'm asking about 1983.
I understand that, Your Honor. I think it would.
You don't need to concede.
Could. Thank you, Your Honor.
May I ask you one question on your theory?
Certainly.
Do you think there's a difference between a negligence case involving a truck going off the road, say, and losing the mail for that reason, and a negligence allegation such as one may read this complaint as making, in which the negligence alleged is that the officers did exactly what they thought they were supposed to do, and the particular acts they did were deliberate in that sense, but there was negligence either in their failing to read their regulations or in their superiors in instructing them. Is this case the same, as in your view, as a case involving you just sloppy handling of mail?
Well, you know, that truck driver thought he was doing the right thing just before he went off the road, too. He thought he was driving a beautiful automobile.
Your answer is it is the same.
I think it is the same. Right. I've been thoroughly distracted from my argument, Your Honor, but I feel that all the points that I wanted to cover have been covered.
That often happens here. It's a great great tribute to your questioners, yeah.
Thank you very much, Your
Honor. Mr. Adams?
Yes. May it please the Court. I would like to say initially that we're premature in standing here before you for the reason that we haven't yet had our trial. We haven't yet developed a sufficient record to provide this honorable court with the detailed information, the factual predicate, to reach a determination about whether and to what extent negligence can stand as a cause of action for First Amendment violations.
Well, you're not premature in the sense that the Ninth Circuit held that there was a constitutional violation under some circumstances for failure to allow a prisoner to send mail out of the prison, and that 1983 authorized the statement of a claim for the violation of that right negligently.
Well, the Ninth Circuit, in reaching that determination, was applying existing law that many other circuits, indeed almost all of the other circuits, had already reached similar decisions with respect to, and was not purporting to, well, didn't carry the, if you will, the burden on its shoulders that I would believe that this court does. If this court wishes to resolve an area that is to some extent muddied and may call for some clarification, then it would simply seem to me appropriate that Your Honors have the benefit of a full and complete record indicating just what was going on in relation to the regulation of mail from defendant Pecunier on down to the mailroom clerk. How was responsibility distributed? Who was acting? Who was failing to act? And with what degrees of intent? We could have anything here from inadvertence to gross negligence, to recklessness, to deliberate conduct. And on the other end of the extreme, well,
the deliberate conduct, Counselor.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Insofar as the conduct may have been deliberate,
yeah,
that's covered by your first two causes of action.
Exactly.
Which aren't an issue here.
That's correct, Your Honor. But if we...
In the present posture of the case, there's no question. However, this court decides this case, it's you've got a remand for a trial on your first two causes of action. That's clear, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, that is clear. And in a way, that stands as an argument, at least from the standpoint of judicial economy,
mm-hmm,
for making the remand now and watching the case and considering the bringing of it back once the trial has been had and a sufficient record developed, so that a more decisive and clear, a more effective standard that would be more meaningful and provide more guidance through the other circuits could then be devised.
Mr. Adams, don't you think we realized that when we voted to take this case?
I don't know.
Well, couldn't you assume that and proceed with your argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. Let me just pass beyond that initial point.
In saving and judicial time.
If it is the wish, then, of the court to reach a determination at this point in respect to negligence, let me say that there are two basic reasons that it seems to me that negligence should be allowed as a cause of action in respect to the First Amendment. And they go to the purposes of that amendment, the purposes that Congress had in mind, those purposes being, as I understand them, deterrence and compensation. And dealing first with deterrence, this court carefully explored the question of the extent to which compensation should be provided and the extent to which immunity should be allowed to state officials in relation to conduct involving the exercise of discretion. And in the cases of Schuer v. Rhodes and Wood v. Strickland, that I'm sure Your Honors are extremely familiar with, that balance was struck with a certain degree of deference given to the importance of state officials engaging in decisive action, and an acknowledgement that the public interest called for that. Now, what we may well have here on the part of those officials who were exercising discretion in relation to the regulation of prisoner mail is a failure to act, an abdication from the exercise of any discretion whatsoever, a failure to look at the options. And if petitioner's request is honored by this court, and if the opportunity to obtain money liability against such state officials as those is the effective result of a determination by this court, that in effect is granting absolute immunity for a complete abdication. It undercuts the very moving rationale of Schuer v. Rhodes and Wood v. Strickland. If we look for a moment for guidance to the common law, as this court has in deciding immunity questions in relation to 1983, we'll find that the common law, when it deals with conduct that is not the exercise of discretion, but rather ministerial in character, liability and negligence is generally allowed. This is the prevailing rule.
Are you talking about the contours of the First Amendment right or about some limitation that 1983 puts on the First Amendment right?
I'm talking about limitations that 1983 would put on litigation under any constitutional guarantee, including the First Amendment.
So in other words, you think then if you had brought an action in the Superior Court of California under the Constitution, assuming you could do that, where you weren't limited by whatever limitations 1983 may impose, that there'd be no question that you could recover, say, for a negligent failure to get the mail out of the prison as a result of a truck accident?
If we assume in your hypothetical, Your Honor, that common law immunities and limitations to those common law immunities as established, for example, in California, governed, yes, I would have no problem with immunity because dealing with negligence, at least in the form of failure to act, inadvertent failure to act, we're not talking about the exercise of discretion. And California has made perfectly clear the case that I have cited in my brief, Johnson v. State, that even were discretion out of the exercise, but in the actual fact of the instance that caused an injury, it was not, then the immunity that ordinarily would enclose that particular official or the governmental entity that he represents is not available. And that official stands fully exposed to negligence liability as though the act were ministerial from the outset.
Well, what if you have a situation where the city has a park with an amplifier system that it makes available to all sorts of different political groups, and you represent a group that has had the park made available to it, and the amplifier system breaks down due to failure of proper maintenance on the part of the city? Is that a violation of your group's First Amendment rights?
Okay, I would say not, Your Honor.
Why is that different from the mail truck running off the road?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. First of all, let me say at the outset that I quite agree with certain of the questions by the court addressed to the petitioner, that my third cause of action deals with misreading of the regulations, and it does not purport to include factual inadvertence by subordinates, you know, subordinate prison officials such as posed in that mail truck hypothetical. In answer, however, to your hypothetical, and also to a situation of misreading of regulations, such as directly is raised in my Third Amendment, third cause of action, I think we need to look at the overall course of action, the overall pattern or implied policy that's being pursued by the subordinate officials to decide if there's liability or not. In other words, there's a balancing test that needs to be undergone, and we need to look at the severity and degree of the harm that's being risked to the people at the, you know, who are subject to the power of that particular governmental official. And I would concede that an isolated instance of inadvertent conduct by an official who is otherwise prudent, you know, who is not an official who engages habitually in careless conduct, be that careless misreading of regulations or be that being careless and driving the mail truck down the road, then there's no liability under 1983 for such an official.
Is there any carelessness under 1983 at all?
Well, indeed, I would believe that there is, Your Honor. I've sought to contend.
Well, certainly 1983 was a Ku Klux Klan Act,
yeah,
and they weren't careless.
Certainly not, but the governmental officials who failed to track down and bring the Ku Klux Klaners to justice many times were. And this is something that was squarely in the minds of the Congress, the members of Congress who were debating that act.
It was.
And I've quoted in my brief, Your Honor.
Yeah, I read that.
Certain places where
that was. It's quite a lot on the other side, too.
Well, I don't mean to take up the course time with quotes. I probably, as a matter, as an upshot of the legislative history,
why would it's
rather ambiguous. Quotes can be raised from both sides, and I think we need to look at current conditions to decide.
What do you do about the mail truck questions? The mail truck deliberately runs up on the curb and hits somebody.
Well, it depends on whether that person has a constitutional right.
He's just a careless driver. That's the 14th time he did it. Does that violate 1983?
I think probably not, Your Honor. And a distinction I want to make in answer to your hypothetical is that if there's no constitutional right involved, it's a matter for the state courts.
We're getting nearer to that. If he drives the mail truck up on the curb 13 times in a period of 2 years and hits somebody.
Well, if those 13 times were each time directed at picketers, let's say, who were exercising their First Amendment rights along the sidewalk, yes, there we have a course of conduct, and even if...
By the mail truck driver?
If he's using a government instrumentality to interfere with First Amendment rights, I think we would have a 1983 cause of action. But if they were simply pedestrians or people that he didn't like...
And all he did, he ran through a red light.
Well, I would adhere to the distinction of an isolated instance versus a course of conduct.
What my real problem?
Although that really seems to suggest intentionality in your hypothetical.
What you say, you want to prove that these people deliberately denied them the rights because they did not understand the regulations. Whatever you're trying to say, why didn't you say it? You're stuck with your language.
Why didn't I say it in the complaint?
Why did you say that you were only talking about negligence?
Because the
first two counts.
From the two items of mail where there are any facts at all in regard to what happened, it would appear that what occurred was just a blatantly negligent misreading of the applications. We have 8 items of mail that were returned to Mr. Navarrete. From the correctional counselors named in the complaint. And why did they return that mail to him? Because the mail was not legal, not business, and not personal, they said in their note to him. Now, that had absolutely nothing to do with the regulations.
Is that in this record?
It's...
I saw one. That's all I saw was one. Did I...
It's not in the record before, Your Honor, now.
I'm not talking about that because I haven't seen that.
I believe this is physically in the clerk's office. And
yeah, well, I don't go and read them all until after the case is argued.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not in the appendix that's been printed for the court.
But you did say that all you're talking about is negligence. And to me, negligence means driving to a red light. To me, when you say negligence, I don't get the idea that you mean somebody deliberately misread rules or regulations.
Certainly not deliberately misread rules and regulations. And if that's what we have, then my existing causes of action that are not before this court would cover the matter. But if, on the other hand, we have a sloppy misreading of the regulations or sloppy practices in terms of the unwritten supplemental rules that may well exist at the solid ed prison level that I don't know about yet because all I've received in the summary judgment motion were the statewide regulations that Pecunier himself drafted. I don't know what existed at the state, at the prison level, but there may well have been negligent misinterpretation of things there. The refusal to send the packet of draft writs of habeas corpus in December of 1971 off to the Prison Law Project may well have been a negligent misunderstanding by the mailroom clerk as to his duties in the matter.
Isn't part of your problem here an effort to plead a 1983 complaint out of a personal injury form book, really?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's certainly no personal injury form book was used by me in drafting this complaint. It was an attempt to match the law under 1983 with the facts of this case as I understood them.
Mr. Adams? I've understood what you said. You would agree that an isolated act of negligence would not implicate Section 1983.
That's correct, Your Honor.
In this case, as I understand the facts, 13 or 17 items of mail were not delivered, whereas a total
25 items, Your Honor.
25? Yes. I thought the other counsel said 17 or
13. Well, he miscounts.
Well, how many were delivered? I'll ask you to answer that.
How many were not delivered?
No. Well, you've told us 25 were not delivered.
Yes.
How many items of this type mail were delivered?
Opposing counsel is correct on that when he says something over 150. My count would indicate 160 to 170. There's a rather illegible mail log that was supplied by petitioner at the time of summary judgment that's part of this record, and it's difficult to count from it, but it's something over 150. So we're talking about 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 of this man, a ratio of 1 to 6 or 1 to 7,
if
this man's mail were interfered with.
Your position then is that 25 acts of negligence out of 160, 175 constitute a course of conduct.
It may well, Your Honor. At this point, I don't know. I need to find that out. This is simply another reason why we have an insufficient record to... in my view, for the court to make a determination. We're not talking about a concept that can either be plugged into 1983 or taken out of 1983 whole cloth. We're talking about a concept of reasonableness in relation to risk of harm to others that is already interwoven with the decisions of this court, particularly the qualified immunity decisions. That depends on the meaning of particular amendments, and I would point out to Your Honors that that a decision in favor of respondents' position here does not open any Pandora's box for a greater volume of cases, because we're talking about a decision simply in relation to the First Amendment.
Well, I had thought, Counsel, that the court, in narrowing the question as it did, was trying to pass on what the Ninth Circuit's opinion said. His allegations, your client's allegations, that state officers negligently deprived him of those rights, state a 1983 cause action, and that's the only issue in the case, not what kinds of acts are negligent or not, that's for the trial, but whether negligence, the question here is whether negligence is ever covered under any circumstances by 1983, at least under the narrow, limited question on which the review was granted.
Yes, and my answer in brief to that, Your Honor, would be that there's no bar within the intrinsic meaning of the First Amendment to negligence, such as there is in the Eighth Amendment. Intrinsically, that calls for a deliberate indifference standard. The 14th Amendment, equal protection, for example, I would agree with counsel that this court has found an intent, a requirement of intent on the part of the acting state officials intrinsic in that particular constitutional guarantee. However, when we look at the First Amendment...
You use the word shall, which is a sort of a intent. The 14th Amendment
nor shall any state.
Yes, and that language of the 14th Amendment is consistent with the decisions of this court and supports a meaning of intent. Not all constitutional guarantees are framed in terms of the state of mind of the acting state official, and the First Amendment is one of those that does not. If you, Your Honors, would consider cases like Edwards v. South Carolina, Finer v. New York, cases that involve, police conduct with situations that are unruly, possibly involve disturbing of the peace. We have a speaker or some marchers exercising First Amendment rights. The question about whether First Amendment rights were involved there or not doesn't turn on the state of mind of the police official. It doesn't turn on whether he was exercised the utmost diligence in protecting their rights, or whether he was a little bit reckless or negligent or whatever you might say in regard to those rights. It doesn't turn on that, but rather the independent examination by this court of the record. So we're not talking about an intent obstacle in the First Amendment.
Well, the First Amendment says shall also, doesn't it?
Well, it says there shall be no law.
It says Congress shall make no law.
But when we go beyond
abridging
the making
of
the laws
or of the press, it says shall, same as
Well,
equal protection.
In relation to the initial maker of the law, but then those laws are applied and
of course, if we wanted to be completely literal, this wouldn't be a First Amendment case at all, because this doesn't involve Congress, does it?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Adams, I wonder, Justice Stewart's focus is on the word make no law. Is part of your submission that in the negligent application of a regulation, you're talking about a law, a legal rule as applied to your client? It doesn't really make much difference whether the law is drafted to say this mail shall be destroyed or if in a practice repeatedly they destroy certain kinds of letters. That's in the nature of a law abridging the freedom of expression as applied to your client. Whereas when a truck goes off the road, that isn't even arguably a law abridging anybody's freedom of expression. Is that the distinction you were seeking to draw?
Yes, Your Honor, I would be in agreement with that. I seek to provide a comprehensive opportunity for my client to prove in court that in one way or another, in the intentional, whether through the deliberate drafting of the law or whether through a negligent follow-up in the preparation of those regulations, be that follow-up on the part of the supervisory defendants in failing to train or supervise or get feedback from the defendants on the line, so to speak, in terms of mail evaluation, or negligence in terms of the defendants on the line in terms of trying with some modicum of prudence and diligence to be consistent, you know, to follow the what would at least be a reasonable meaning of those regulations, then those rights have been violated. There are a few other points that I would like to briefly advert to that arose in the questions of the petitioning attorney. First of all, briefly in relation to the right of access, I say it at length on footnote 2, page 3 of my brief, why I now press it, even though indeed I did now in retrospect inadvisedly concede the right of access in written argument both before the District Court and Court of Appeals. In terms of the coverage, the constitutional coverage of the conduct here involved, the sending and receiving of, well, the sending of mail, the First Amendment free expression, as I see it, is completely coterminous with the right of access. The distinction then, the materiality of the right of access has to do only with the history of the development of these rights. The right of access is an older right and has a longer history to it. That distinction, in my view, became more material when Wood v. Strickland was decided, because I talked about subtle constitutional rights. And I think there's if this court were to take petitioner's view that only a decision by this court itself were to establish a right to be settled within the meaning of Wood v. Strickland, then obviously I'm out in the cold as far as free expression goes, because although, as I've argued in my brief, there were some district court decisions that, in my view, reasonably and very clearly let defendant Pecunier know, he being party in a couple of those suits, and as well as some of the other defendants, know that there was prisoner free expression already, reasonably in advance of 1971-72. There's no decision by this court until Martinez v. Pecunier, where there was the beginning of an acknowledgement of that right, and then Pell v. Pecunier very shortly thereafter, where it was made express that indeed prisoners have a certain measure of First Amendment free expression. In terms of right of access, Johnson v. Avery was decided much earlier, and that could have been a foundation for at least that right. So, indeed, candidly, I made the concession before. If the court wants to deal with the question of that I think really is not properly before this court as a matter of the question on which cert was granted, but if the court should wish to deal with it, I would suggest that it might be in the interest of making a decision that gives good guidance to to the circuit courts, the lower federal courts that will be reading this decision, to look at all the rights that the facts fairly raise, and I think that the facts do fairly raise right of access as well as free expression. There's another question that may be in the minds of this court in relation to the allowing of negligence that I would like to address myself to briefly, and that's whether the relief that might be available in state court isn't really sufficient for the kind of harm that we're speaking of here. And I would suggest to Your Honors that it's really not, that we need a federal forum, the forum of 1983, and a federal perspective in order to properly grant compensatory relief. Because we're talking about different interests, not just common law interests, you know, injury to person, injury to property. We're talking about constitutional interests. And as Justice Harlan said very eloquently in his concurring opinion in Monroe v. Pape, those interests are fundamentally different in character and often would call for a different measure of damages in order to provide compensation. For example, in the Troy v. Dulles case, 356 U.S., involving a decision by this court that the Eighth Amendment was violated by the denationalization of an individual. There was no physical mistreatment, but yet the total destruction of the individual's status in organized society violated that constitutional right. There would have been no damages at common law. And what about the right of an individual to vote or to attend an integrated school? What's the common law money damages there? And what about Mr. Navarrete right here? Common law perspective, handful of mail. What's it worth? But when we look at it from a constitutional perspective, we're talking about this man's effort to communicate with the world outside him. And that has a certain value in terms of the rehabilitation of this man.
Conceding all that, again, I thought the issue before the court was whether negligence producing that consequence is covered by 1983.
Yes, Your Honor. And although this hasn't been squarely decided by this court, I would submit that if the court would be a logical and plausible extension from the immunity decisions that this court has made that negligence should lie. The court has looked in the past in Wood v. Strickland and Schuer v. Rhodes to the common law for guidance. And if we look here to the common law, we'll find that state officials, that public officials, are subject to negligence liability, where their acts are ministerial in character and not the active exercise of discretion.
Liable in the state courts is what you mean, do you?
What's that now?
Do you mean liable in the state courts or liable under 1983?
That would be liability in the state courts.
No.
That's the way the common law resolves the problem. And while that's not something that should be followed as an automatic matter in dealing with 1983, it's there being a greater interest in attaching liability because the purpose, after all, of 1983 is to provide relief for the infliction of constitutional harm by state officials. We should at least go as far as the common law goes. And on that basis, I would urge that negligence be allowed. Thank you.
Thank you. You have about 4 minutes left, Mr.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Dove.
The Ninth Circuit stated, the section referring to Section 1983 places no narrow limitation on the nature or quality of the conduct which it makes actionable, but concerns itself entirely with the consequences of that conduct.
Where are you reading from?
I'm reading from the appendix to the petition for certiorari at page 7. And then on page 8 goes on to say, the allegations that state officers negligently deprived him of those rights, referring to the First Amendment rights, states a 1983 cause of action. We filed our writ from that ruling.
Yep.
Now, The Ninth Circuit construed the third cause of action to state a cause of action in negligence. If this court, or a majority of this court, reads it as stating some other cause of action, as habitual misreading of statutes and regulations reads to us, deliberate indifference, then he doesn't need a negligence cause of action. And the Ninth Circuit, insofar as it held that negligence states the cause of action, was misreading what this complaint was all about. But the court, I think, should go further and unequivocally hold that if it does indeed allege negligence, because he must mean negligence here, he said deliberate indifference in his first two causes of action, then we decide that under no circumstances does negligence state a cause of action. And I think that this court's decisions, particularly Estelle versus Gamble, Paul versus Davis, Rizzo versus Good, support the proposition that negligence does not state a cause of action under 1983. The pattern of error by subordinate officials has to be something more than negligence. It's got to be so egregious, widespread, and continuing as to permit an inference of deliberate indifference. And we read deliberate indifference to mean some sort of affirmative intentional conduct or a refusal to act upon a clear duty. Now, I want to clear up the point about whether there are 13 items or 25 items that Justice Powell raised. The complaint lists 13 items of mail, Justice Powell. It is true that some of those apparently have multiple addressees. I think one of the items was reproduced 8 times and put in 8 different envelopes and sent, and when it was turned in, there were a package of 8 alleged. That's one item of 8. So if you add up the multiples, it comes up to 25 letters in respondents' parlance, but we accept his listing of 13 items. There were 13 letters, as we see it. Some of them had multiple copies, to clear that up. Now, I have a fairness question that I have difficulty in dealing with. Counsel seems to say that Mr. Pecunier, the director of the California Department of Corrections, should have known about the inmate's First Amendment right of free expression back in 1971 and 72 because he was in court, in the lower courts, district court and circuit court, litigating the question. But Mr. Pecunier was here in 1974, and this court didn't tell him anything about an inmate's right of free expression. And I have there's a basic unfairness in coming, in telling him now, you should have known it. In 1972, when he wasn't told about it in 1974. And I'd submit it on that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments.